Well, it's great to be back in Santa Barbara, particularly after minus 65 Fahrenheit wind chill in Alberta. So it's nice to come here to warm up a little bit. And thanks for the warm welcome here. So I'm going to talk about a variety of different things: Hartle Hawking wave function, typicality, Boltzmann brains, and the proposal I have that may or may not be useful. So one question in physics we have is, why is the universe comprehensible? Einstein said the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is comprehensible. Well, this may be even a metaphysical thing. I mean, a theistic explanation is created by an omniscient God who comprehends fully and created humans in his image, comprehend partially. But at scientific level, we know how do observers within the universe have ordered observations and comprehensions of the universe. I mean, how is the universe comprehensible more? You know, even if it had elegant laws of physics, it might be comprehensible to somebody outside, but why is it comprehensible to us within the universe? This raises up questions of Boltzmann brains I'll get to a little later. But before we get to this, in physics, we'd like to have a complete model of the universe. And one part, of course, are physical variables and dynamical laws, which some people call theory of everything, though I think you'd need more than that. You need the correct solution of dynamical laws, which we have the very beautiful work by Jim Hartle and Stephen Hawking as a prototype for that. And then I would also argue that ultimately we need the connection with conscious experience. What conscious experiences occur in a given quantum state? But that's more for the future. But so,
would you say it wouldn't suffice to have an explanation of how, say, some kind of robotic detector makes measurements? Consciousness has to be part of it.
Well, I would say to explain what I'm aware of, I think it would need to be to have something that would include the consciousness. I mean, so far we have no inkling of what structures are conscious and what are not. I mean, so for example, I think probably most of us are conscious. Let's assume all of you are sighted. It looks like you look around. So I assume most of you have visual impressions, but I suspect, like you're not aware of your heartbeat right now. You're not consciously aware of it. But presumably information about both is being processed in your brain. So I think, I don't see anything in current physics or even in superstring theory that would logically imply that we're conscious of what we see, but we're not conscious of our heartbeat, for example. So I think something else is good. This is debatable, but I think something else is needed there.
But a robotic detector wouldn't be an equally good model for something that makes observations and so on.
Well, it depends. I mean, it may or may not be conscious. I can't prove the robots aren't conscious, but although my suspicion is that probably most robots we'd make would have very low, very, very tiny measure of consciousness, but that's just a suspicion.
Well, Kelman and Hartle only asked for what they call IGIS.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, so, I mean, this is an ultimate, I mean, the conscious part, I think, is an ultimate goal. I'm just saying that we can't say that we're done once we have even the theory, the TOE, which is just dynamics, and the boundary conditions, which Jim and Stephen Hawking have worked on. I think that would not be enough. If we really got to get a theory that describes everything we know about, everything we know about includes consciousness. Now, there may be other things we don't know about, but at least it should include what we know about, which I'd say includes consciousness. So, okay. So the Hartle-Hawking has proposed a very beautiful, though, boundary proposal that the quantum state of the universe, say, is a functional of the three geometry, and this is schematic for the matter fields on this three geometry. It's given by a path integral over four-dimensional geometries and four-dimensional matter fields, and then using Euclidean form weighted by exponential minus Euclidean action. Now, it's incomplete for various technical reasons, such as the non-renormalizability of Einsteinian gravity, so you may have to go to some string theory or something else. But it has been very nice. The toy models have seemed to predict various observed features of the universe. So, for example, if when you do this, you can get Lorentzian signature out from a WKB limit. You can find that you basically can include WKB approximation, which you have complex solutions, and then the actual will be complex. You can get oscillating wave functions, and these can lead you to Lorentzian signature. It's also found that you can get large size from inflation. If you have an inflaton in the theory's part of the matter field, you can get inflation and near critical density, low anisotropies. The universe would, the anisotropy tends to be damped. Inhomogeneity is starting in the ground state, which is very good. So it would be good initial conditions for inflation to develop the inhomogeneities we see, and also low initial entropy, which can help explain the arrow of time. So there's.
Can I ask about the first line? Is it guaranteed that you only get one time, or is that built in the one time?
Well, in some sense, I guess if the wave function, if it has this oscillatory behavior, then I guess you're saying that the direction which it's oscillating is the one time. But I don't know. I haven't thought. Maybe Jim can say what.
Well, if you take the sort of simplest possible picture where you have sort of Euclidean instant time, and it's joined smoothly onto the Lorentzian geometry, that's the extremizing geometry, then you can only have one time. Because if there were two times, it wouldn't match across the possible match Euclidean to Lorentzian.
Okay.
So that's one kind of explanation. I don't think it's the world's greatest. I mean, deepest explanation. The simplest picture does give up only one time.
Yeah, so maybe open question to see, can anybody get two times? I mean, of course, it also has Euclidean parts of this, too, so it doesn't necessarily predict exactly. It's either maybe zero or one, but I don't know if anybody's tried to look for two out of here. But
maybe. The point is, if you have one time, then the time-like direction of the Lorentzian geometry can be in the surface of the matching. But two times, it couldn't match on.
Yeah, okay, that's right, you couldn't match.
In what sense the rest of your features, I mean, are connected with Hartle-Fockian? These are the, I mean, the features.
Well, I'm saying a certain
point. Inflation, there are properties of inflation. It has nothing to do with the Hartle-Fockian as in boundary conditions.
Well, it leads to the right boundary conditions for inflation. You need initial boundary conditions for inflation.
Well, I don't agree with you on that.
Well, okay, we can discuss that later. But you need very special. I think Penrose and others have shown you need very special initial conditions for inflation, and it helps. It does at least in toy models. It seems to give that, and it also tends to give ground states that you get. Whereas, of course, if you had a collapsing universe, you wouldn't get deflation because you're not starting off the right boundary conditions. Okay, so I really love this proposal and done a certain amount of work on toy models for this, but then I've been shaken up a bit by a challenge from Lenny Susskind, which I must admit I tend to agree with. Susskind had some points in some of his papers, like down here, but he largely told this verbally, and I gather. So I finally wrote up a summary of this, that now that we know that we have some large inflating universe now with small inflation, that there's something like a small positive cosmological constant or quintessence or something, and the argument is that to get a big universe to match onto a great big universe today, you could have a large instanton corresponding to this tiny value of the cosmological constant, and this would have a very, very hugely negative action. So e to the minus action would be e to a enormous positive number. So this would tend to dominate the thing. So it's a variant of Vilenkin's old objection, because Vilenkin and Starbinsky and others had wave functions with the opposite sign in, such that, you know, bigger instantons would be suppressed. Here, so it's a variant of that, but now it's even more severe because we have this tiny cosmological constant. So now you might say, well, okay, we could save it by using anthropic ideas that we can only exist in part, but this doesn't seem to work because it's apparently more probable. You have such an enormous exponential factor for the action that will dominate over the exponential suppression, the tiny, for an observer to fluctuate. So as Dyson, Clement, and Susskind point, as the danger is there's too many possibilities which are anthropically acceptable, but not like our universe. So, for example, I quoted there was expressed by Eddington 75 years ago. He said, the crude assertion would be that unless we admit something which is not chance in the architecture of the universe, it is practically certain that at any assigned date, the universe will be almost in the state of maximum disorganization. The amended assertion, and here he's implicitly using something like anthropic things, the amended assertion is that unless we admit something which is not chance in the architecture of the universe, it is practically certain that a universe containing mathematical physicists will at any assigned date be at the state of maximum disorganization, which is not inconsistent with the existence of such creatures. So Eddington himself saw putting in selection effects of, but then Edison goes on to say, I think it is quite clear that neither the original nor the amended version applies. We're thus driven to admit anti-chance, and apparently the best thing we can do with it is sweep it up into a heap at the beginning of time. So anyway, so this is what that it seems to be, that this is saying that you will tend to end up to this big De Sitter thing, and it has this very low temperature, this very low De Sitter temperature, and very very high entropy. So let's put some numbers in just to illustrate this. Okay, the Hubble Space Telescope gives H naught around. Let's just ignore the uncertainties, and in Planck units, it's that. And the WMAP results, the contribution to omega from the cosmological constant about 0.72. Let's just ignore the errors. So then the cosmological constant in Planck units is roughly this. The radius of the De Sitter space that you get it from pure cosmological constant is that in Planck units. The entropy of the De Sitter thing is about this. So then the, you put that, e to the minus that, into the... For the amplitude, square the amplitude, get the probability. So this is the same as the for a complete four sphere. So the probability, because it comes with e to the minus action and the action's negative, it's e to the plus an enormous number. E to the 10 to the 122.44 is this huge thing. So that you could get. But if you had this big empty universe, you could still have observers appearing. And there's different, depending on what assumptions, they're of course exponentially suppressed, but how much? If you said that, for example, a brain appeared just long enough, just barely existed, and then went combined back with the antimatter, then you'd have to get the energy of a brain separated from the antimatter by, say, the size of a human brain. So let's say human brain 1 kilogram, and put the speed of, you have the h-bar c, so there's a c squared up there, which cancels c there. So, and then, say, 30 centimeters for the antimatter, you have the brain here, and the antimatter is separated from it. And then, divide by that, you get e to the 10 to the 42. Yes?
Why does an observer, or the function observer, necessarily have to be separate from whatever you call the universe itself? Why can't there be self-awareness as the primary function of the universe?
Well, I suppose I'm saying that the universe. No, I'm not necessarily it has to be separate.
Why do you have to have a brain to have observation? Or
well, I don't know, but I'm saying that the problem comes from having too many observing things. So you'd have even more problems if you had other things observing. So I'm saying suppose I say as a minimum that if I do get, so I'm leaving aside, it would be even worse problems if other things could be conscious. I mean, we'd have even worse problems of rocks and so on. But for this argument, I'm saying, what's the minimum? And so I'm asking different minima of what could be. So there's different possibilities here depending on what you'd accept. If you would accept that if a brain is in the right state, so that you've got the, in this region, a region of about 30 centimeters across, you have the right configuration with a brain there that if that would be conscious, then you'd need about this much action. Now you might say, well, we maybe for consciousness we need it to last for a certain length of time. So you could say, well, it lasts for a tenth of a second, then you get an action that's quite a bit bigger, but it's still a finite number, it's not anywhere near this number. And then if you want it to last arbitrarily long, you could just say, well, we form it by thermal fluctuation in the De Sitter space, and then it could be in some sense have real existence, or I mean it doesn't just disappear shortly, then the action's quite a bit bigger. So let's suppose we put this in, then we can say, okay, if we take the unnormalized, in some sense, this bare probability here, we get that. So now, but now let's add the brain. So we have this part for the instanton formation, and then this suppression factor for the brain, but we got this huge positive factor in this. So this is, and I put greater than or equal to because I put this, the most conservative approach there. So, on the other hand, if we suppose we have inflation with a large value of a scalar field, then that gives a smaller, there's a smaller De Sitter thing at the inflation, and you can get, depending, I mean, this is the smaller it is, the less the negative action, the closer the action is to zero. This is the biggest one possible just to give the minimum amount of E falling. So you get that. So therefore, if you say, if you want to get the normalized probability of inflation, you have to divide by the sum of these two. So divide by the sum, then you basically get this. So in other words, having inflation, because the negative action is this quantity, which is much less than this, it's much suppressed compared to that. So if you ask the probability of this versus that, then you divide, and even though, so this number really counts for negligible compared to this. And so you get that the probability, normalized probability of inflation is very tiny. So on the other hand, the problem, yes?
How many defaults of inflation are you assuming?
Well, to get this number, I was assuming minimum, I think, about 60 or something. So, I mean, it will, I mean, if you... Well, no, it just makes this, then if it goes on forever, then it means the seed state was smaller. So then it means the action is less negative. So this number tends to zero. The more the more inflation there was, then the smaller this number would be. So I'm saying you get the biggest if you have the smallest number of e-folds, and that means you start off with that you indicate the thing. So then the idea is that if this were right, it would say in this Hartle-Hawking state, you would, then you would most likely, most brains would be produced by either vacuum or thermal fluctuations. But that is, I believe, inconsistent with observations, because if we did form by vacuum or thermal fluctuations, the probability of having an ordered state would be the number of states with ordered observations divided by the total number of states that would be conscious at all, and surely this would be tiny. I don't know how to calculate this, but I think it's pretty clear there must be a lot more states in which things are, you're conscious, but you're highly disordered than the states in which, you know, we have this beautiful Kavli Institute around us or such things.
Now, again, the e to the 10.6 was from what?
So this was assuming that you nucleate a little de Sitter thing that corresponds to an initial value of the inflaton that just barely gives you, say, 60 e-folds. So just the minimum amount. So because, of course, if you had more, then you would basically be starting up. Well, and this is also for a massive scalar field. It's taking the data from some of Lindy's books. A massive scalar field, and it's just if you had more inflation, it meant you started higher up. So when you start higher up, you have more energy density. That means your de Sitter thing is smaller, so the action is less negative. So this number would be smaller. So it's basically just saying that the de Sitter part of the universe at the beginning of ordinary inflation is much smaller than the de Sitter radius of the universe today, which is given by the present value of the cosmological constant. So that's what that is. So because of this, I certainly don't believe that we are one of these Boltzmann brains, or we are one of these observers that appear in here. You could also put in, if you weren't happy with this, you could put the whole Earth or the whole solar system or the whole galaxy. And, you know, the action will get bigger, but it won't approach this. So it's much easier to just have a whole galaxy or even a whole cluster of galaxies form as a fluctuation in a big de Sitter space than to have inflation in this model. So that's sort of the challenge to the model. Well, there's possible resolutions for this about observers and stuff that maybe observers can't observe from de Sitter fluctuations. Maybe it's impossible. You need something else. Maybe you say, well, inflation has a negative action that's only maybe minus 10 to the whatever it was. Maybe that's calculated by some tube to some great big region that has a huge negative action. But if you do that for inflationary region, if you allow it to be connected to a big de Sitter, why can't you take our big de Sitter and connect it to another one? I mean, if you're allowed to make the action more negative by connecting on to a big de Sitter, why are you allowed to do that for inflation but not for our big universe? I mean, I'm not saying there's no answer. I mean, I'm just saying it's a challenge. Maybe you can do that. Maybe you could say there is an extrema. Maybe you're supposed to look at maybe the path integral is supposed to be dominated by extrema, and maybe it turns out there is an extremum that connects inflation to Sitter, but none connecting to de Sitters. I mean, that could be a matter of investigation, though you'd have to look at inhomogeneous geometries. It looks very hard. I don't know how you'd ever do this. Maybe Euclidean de Sitter for this big thing is not an allowed extremum. Maybe there's some rules that the path integral, you're supposed to do it over, not over that extremum. Or maybe the actual dark energy doesn't give an allowed extreme. Maybe it's sufficiently different from a cosmological constant, you don't get an extreme. I mean, again, I don't know why, but that, of course, is this big problem, the measure problem in cosmology, and maybe the solution to that will solve this too. Another one that might is, you might say, well, suppose we had an initial value of the scalar field and we allowed the scalar field to be arbitrarily large. Then there's, you might say, there's an infinite measure on this infinitely large space of conditions for that. So if you might suppose that you could say that somehow this integral, the range of this is sort of bigger than this number. That sounds fantastic, but maybe that's a possible solution. Maybe then you might say, well, maybe inflation produces a very big universe. It produces something that the number of observers dominates over this. But then you might say, well, why not the De Sitter? The De Sitter also expands to become infinitely large, so why doesn't it also have an infinite number? So, you know, there's possible ways out. It's not quite, you know, clear what the right one is. Let me go back and talk a little bit more about these different kinds of observers. This is related to this.
So, can I ask you a question? A couple years ago, Andy Albrecht came here and gave a talk.
Right.
And somehow he had completely opposite conclusions to Susskind and Albrecht. How does that fit into this?
Well, I don't. Was he assuming the Hartle-Hawking?
I think so.
No boundary proposal. I mean, I think he was doing some inflation.
Okay.
I'd have to look, but I'm not absolutely.
All right.
So. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that all proposals give that. It's just a proposal that allows a Euclidean action that's very negative with a big two. That's what seems to be giving the problem. This huge thing up in the exponential, e to the minus action, and if the action's very, very negative, that seems to be giving the problem. And so I'm raising the challenge for this. I mean,
okay. Why the inflation cannot match that? What's your argument behind that?
Well, I'm just saying the inflation, the Euclidean part is very small, so the action for it is much less negative.
But what if you have eternal inflation?
Well, but the eternal inflation is happening in Lorentzian, so that doesn't contribute. That contributes an imaginary piece to the Euclidean action. So it doesn't amplify the thing. It's basically because it's e to the minus. E to the I times the Lorentzian action, so that's e to the minus the Euclidean action. So the Lorentzian part of the action causes phases. It doesn't make the amplitude. So the eternal inflation doesn't help as far as that goes. Now I suppose it would if you weighted by the number of observers, and it really gave far more observers than the De Sitter. But it's not obvious because the ordinary De Sitter expands. If you let it expand forever, it will expand to infinitely big too. And so if these Boltzmann brains can, or even whole galaxies can nucleate anywhere in there, you also have an infinite number of places that can happen. So maybe some way to, you know, there's a measure problem there, and maybe there's a way to solve it that somehow allows eternal inflation to win over this other, but it's not obvious. Okay, let's just think, there's ordinary observers, honest folk ourselves. I attribute this to Lindy, but then Busso pointed out he'd said it first. So I guess he's a bit more originally ordinary. So there are ones that arise from non-equilibrium processes like we believe happened for us, Darwinian evolution by natural selection. And we don't know, of course, the detail, but a reasonable fraction might be expected to have ordered observations, memories, and comprehensions. I mean, we don't know that biological evolution will lead to creatures like us that have ordered things, but it doesn't seem that implausible that they can do that. Boltzmann brains, on the other hand, it goes back, although Boltzmann himself didn't talk about brains, but he did talk about thermal fluctuation. If you had a thermal equilibrium, the thermal fluctuations might occur. And he was a little reluctant even to take full credit, so he just said this was an idea of his old assistant, Dr. Schutz. Andy Albrecht, who I think he coined the phrase Boltzmann brain, he said maybe we should call it Schutz smarts. So anyway, so these could be thermal fluctuations, as in the De Sitter temperature, or just vacuum fluctuations. So, but of these, a very tiny fraction would give consciousness. But then of these, a very fraction would give ordered observations. Well, I say co-observations in quote. Most of them would be illusions. It would just be that their brain happened to be such that they thought they were aware of something. Very attached of those would give ordered observations of more detailed things, such as galaxy-galaxy correlations. Very, very small fraction of those would give ones that actually fit fairly similar to what we see. And even a very tiny fraction of those would be non-illusory. Now, of course, we can't be sure that ours aren't this, but at least we know ours seem to be down to this scale. So just conditionalizing even upon consciousness or even upon seeing galaxy-galaxy correlations, it would be only a very tiny fraction of Boltzmann brains that would see the order that we do. So if we're Boltzmann brains, what we see would be, you know, very, very atypical. So that seems to be evidence against this sort of thing. Now, this all does involve some questions that I'm debating with Jim Harlan, Mark Sudnicki about probabilities and such things. So I like to, this Copernican principle, it says we aren't especially privileged. Weak entropic principle says what we observe is conditioned by our existence as observers. And Alex Vilenkin has a form of the principle of mediocrity that we're a typical civilization. And Nick Bostrom has a whole book on selection effects, anthropic bias selection, observational selection effects. He has what's called the strong self-sampling assumption that one should reason as if one's present observer moment were a random sample from the set of all observer moments in its reference class. I go a little stronger. He waffles a little bit at reference class. I will say I use the conditional esthemic principle, which not coincidentally is the initials of my wife, Kathy Ann Page. The less one has compelling contrary evidence, one should reason as if one's conscious perception were a random sample from the set of all conscious perceptions. So that's meant to rule out that we're not random objects of, say, 100 kilograms. I mean, there's far more rocks than we are, but presumably rocks aren't conscious. So far, it seems to be consistent that maybe we are a random sample of conscious things. You might say, well, there's far more ants than us, but then it's very plausible they don't have as much measure of consciousness as we do. And if, you know, so if that's so, we could very well be typical conscious beings.
But that's a very strong and questionable assumption.
Right. It's, okay, it's a working hypothesis, and it's basically, I guess, of course, you could narrow it down and just say we're typical among things that among humans or among things.
Necessary to define consciousness.
Well, I take consciousness a basic primary thing that can't be defined. It's just you experience it, so you can't, you know, you can't define it. You can, I guess, you could talk about it, but you can't define it in terms of more primary things. So
how can you give electrons something that you can't define?
Well, I take it primer. I mean, it's, I suppose, like in mathematics, you might say, well, how do mathematicians define? Well, I mean, there's some basic things that they use, like, I don't know what, like integers. I mean, how do they some property? I mean, you can define it in terms of other things, but you always have to get to something that's primary.
And consciousness is your primary thing.
So for me, I take the consciousness is a primary fact of the universe that, you know, I observe.
It's a pretty complex primary.
Yeah, I'm sure the details to how do you find the measure for conscious perceptions from the quanta state of the universe, that's probably going to be complex. I mean, we don't know how to get that. So
you can't define it.
So, you know, that would be the challenge. And I'm saying that it's not something that seems to be at all within any current formulation of physics. It doesn't seem to apply. I think I mentioned earlier that I don't see anything in superstring theory that would say that you're conscious of seeing me, but you're not conscious right now of your heartbeat. So, you know, it's something that probably goes beyond superstring theory to solve this, but it's, and I'm not, you know, maybe it's too premature to work on it. I'm not sure, but I think we have to admit that it's a problem that was not solved by present physics, and even if present physics were completed in some dynamical theory of everything, we wouldn't have it.
When you say it's obvious that ants aren't conscious.
No, I'm not saying it's obvious. No.
There is a definition.
Yeah, no. What I'm saying is, we cannot. It's been often argued that that it's clear that we are not typical because there are far more rocks or far more ants. What I'm saying is, it's not obvious. I certainly don't know that we can prove that we have more measure of consciousness than ants do. What I'm saying is that it seems plausible to me. In other words, the working hypothesis that we're typical conscious beings, I don't think it has been falsified yet. Now, the trouble is, to falsify, you'd actually have to have a theory of what quantum states produce what consciousness. We don't have that yet, so it's probably premature to try to falsify it. But I'm saying, in principle, it could be falsified. But what I'm saying is, I don't see any evidence yet that it has been falsified. And so that's the thing. I certainly can't prove that we're typical, even, and I'm proposing in the general reference class, you could try to go back and define in restricted reference classes things that have similar brain structures to us, you know, and that may be more, you know, maybe one can test more things about that. Are we typical beings that have the same brain structure as us or something? I mean, that maybe you could be easier to test.
But again, if we're future eternally to sitter, there could be whole Boltzmann civilizations in our future. And how do we know that we're not atypical in that class of objects? In fact,
yeah, well, I think what I'm saying is, because if I'm saying that we should calculate the likelihoods as the probability of seeing what we see out of a normalized set of all possible observations, then I'm just saying that if we're extremely atypical, the likelihood is low. Now, that may not count, because there are times that we could have theories in which the prior probability is sufficiently higher that even if the likelihood is low, we will accept the theory that gives low likelihood because the prior probability is high. So I'm not saying that this disproves it. It may be the simplest theory is so simple. Maybe there's a theory that has such a high prior probability that even if it predicts we're atypical and left for low likelihood, that may win in the end. But I'm just saying that low likelihood does count against the theory in a Bayesian analysis. Yes?
One thing that seems like it might solve some of this is something that's been thought for many ages, the idea that consciousness, somewhat similar to what you were saying, is more primary than what we're dealing with for the most part in phenomenology. And whether you're dealing with an atom or an ant or a human being, there's a spectrum of consciousness. Paracelsus, the 12th century, was saying that everything is possessed of some consciousness, but from the atom up. It's just a matter of degrees.
Okay, but
if it has any identity at all, whether it's a particle or anything else, there's something that's an identity, which is apart from no identity whatsoever, which is just a pure state, an undefined state. So if it has identity, to see some relationship between identity and consciousness, is what historical philosophy has.
Right, but I think that would acerbate the problem, because if there were many more things that were conscious, I mean, I think it's very likely that higher mammals are probably lower measures of consciousness. Even ants probably may, I suspect, have some degree of consciousness, but very tiny. But if all these things had high measures of consciousness, it'd make us even more atypical. And so I think it would make the problem worse. So
I just want to add one thing. Then going back to the computer, why a machine is, let's say, less conscious or not conscious compared to a human observer, then the significance of the observation would relate back to the causality of the embeddedness of the whole human organism in the larger universal structure and its feedback as a conscious organism, which the machine would have less of a feedback in the larger structure.
Yeah, I mean, it's too early to be sure. What do you need to produce measures of consciousness? And what is it that says one organism has a higher, more measure of consciousness than others? I mean, it's probably, maybe you're onto some ideas for that, but that's premature. But now for the rest of this, we could probably restrict to observers that are rather like us.
There's this great 18th century book by Wandsworth, I think, called The Probability, meaning the High Probability, of Sensation in Vegetables.
I guess the thing is I'm taking it as a working hypothesis that my conscious perception is not too a probable given the correct theory, that it would be more improbable if there was a lot more other consciousness going on. So therefore that makes me a bit suspicious that vegetables have much consciousness, but I can't prove it. So what I'm saying is I at least have the working hypothesis that our perceptions are in some sense typical. They're not too improbable of it. That may be falsified in the future. I don't think it's been falsified yet. Now, and I think, but of course, if Boltzmann brains really dominated, it would be falsified. But I'm arguing that we should have a theory in which Boltzmann brains don't grossly dominate it. Okay, now one thing that raises this issue about how do you calculate this probability is the likelihood of, well, suppose this is the likelihood of a theory given an observation, say the likelihood of the theory I given the observation J, is that, this is what Jim Harlan and Mark Zaretti are debating, is it the probability that the observation occurs somewhere in the theory, somewhere in the universe? In classical mechanics, this would be 1 if the observation occurs, it'd be 0 if not. In quantum mechanics, it might be the expectation value of a projection operator onto this. If this were true, it would not give different likelihoods for theories. Well, if it were this, then if the likelihoods were all 1, you would not distinguish the theories. You could only distinguish them by the priors. You wouldn't have any observational distinction. So if theory TI gives the universe large enough, if it's very big, it would seem that many observations would almost certainly occur somewhere and make the likelihood near unity. So then the posterior probability of the theory given the observation, it would just be highest for the highest prior probability. So, for example, the simple theory that all observations certainly exist. You could give up and not have to do physics. You just say, well, my theory is all observations exist equally and be done with it. That's a simple theory. I've just stated it. But that doesn't seem to be right. It seems like if some observations occur more, for example, a lot lower, surely they should have higher likelihoods. So suppose theory 1 gives one observation of O1 and a million observations of O2, whereas theory 2 gives a million observations of O1 and one observation of O2. Then I would say that we surely should have likelihoods such that the likelihood, if you do see this one, so if you see observation 1, that theory 1 is preferred over theory 2. So you might restrict to theories such that the sum of the likelihoods over all the possible observations is 1, instead of just for over the observation and the negation of the observation, but over all observations of one.
How the hell do you count observations?
Well, we could use...
I could increase the number of observations by doing a lot more experiments. I mean, what does observation mean?
Well, okay.
How many observations of the Balmer spectrum are there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I suppose you can count them up. But, I mean, you might just say, well, okay, we have what? I'm basically trying to count how many from different civilizations. If we have, if we have our civilization, if there's supposed to be other civilizations or maybe other things that appear in Boltzmann brains.
An observation is not, all these things are not defined. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. What is an observation? I know what a possible observation is. I know what a prediction is. Observation depends on whether I feel like doing 10 observations a day or 20 observations. You're going to say that affects.
Well, I mean,
limit to the number of observations I can do.
Well, it might. Okay, I mean, if we went to this Dranen C word in conscious perceptions, you might. I mean, I don't know whether it's true, whether we have a continuum or a discrete number. But suppose we had one every tenth of a second, then maybe there is a limit. That you can only have one every tenth of a second, and then so that the number of humans times the number of.
I don't know what you used these words. This slide has observation 10 times, and haven't told me what it means.
Well, in this, I suppose in this case, I have in mind that there's a million and one civilizations. So I have in mind there's a million and one civilizations that are pretty much identical, except that one of them measures O1, maybe a low value of the Hubble constant, and a million of them measure a high value. And then there's according to the other theory, there should be a million of civilizations observing. Which way did I say? The high value and one measuring the low value.
Yeah, but there's a fallacy here.
You're making observation is a number, a physical parameter. Is that what you mean by that?
Well, the O thing means the result of an observation. For example, the Hubble constant.
By an observation, you mean measurement of a physical parameter?
Yeah, and the result. So for this would be the result of the observation. So you measure. So for example, I could say there. Well, suppose I took two classes. One of them that the fine structure constant is bigger than 0.01 and one that it's smaller than 0.01. So that's classified and then now we measure it. And so we find that it's smaller than 0.01. So that's an observation in our civilization. So suppose there's a million and one of those. And suppose one theory says that, a million of them will see the fine structure constant bigger than 0.01. And one will see it smaller than 0.01. And the other theory says that a million civilizations will see it smaller and one will see it bigger. Then what I'm arguing here is that even if there really does exist both the civilization that sees it less than 0.01 in both theories, I would argue we still should favor the theory in which there is more civilizations seeing it less than 0.01 because, I mean, we see it less than 0.01.
There's a fallacy there. The fallacy is that you're assuming that there's no cross-correlation between these observations. It's as if saying that every civilization is a completely independent observer, But if you have many civilizations in the same universe, they should see pretty much the same thing. So you can have 10 to the 6 observations and they will all be compatible. So that there's no accounting for the fact that they are going to be correlated when you take a particular sample. We cannot make an experiment where we do, you know, 10 to
Well, I'm imagining these others are so far away that it's just inaccessible. You don't have that data. So we just have to ask the probability of the observation. We can't test the correlations between them. So I'm assuming that the case we can't test it. There may be other civilizations out there, and if they're close enough to us, they presumably get the same value of alpha, but we don't have access to that. So we just have to use the information we have access to.
There's something I'd just like to offer in terms of two experiments with consciousness that were done, in terms of observation and consciousness. One was with monkeys, actually, on an island. And they drop these potatoes on the island, on the sand, and on all these different islands. And all of a sudden, and the monkeys were just taking them and eating them. On one island, all of a sudden, the monkeys started washing the potatoes. Then within a very, very short time, all of a sudden, all of the monkeys on all the different islands, with no interchange between them, were suddenly washing them. They've done several.
I better go on because I think but I don't know that this is relevant to the talk, is it?
One thing with consciousness and with the plants, there's a book called The Secret Life of Plants where they've demonstrated there's a consciousness function in plants.
Right. But I'm sort of talking about typicality, so maybe I should discuss this part, that part privately, because I don't understand monkeys. So I'll have to speed up here, but possible principles, what I call Bayesian meta-theories, because I'm an advocate of using Bayesian analysis. You assign prior probabilities to theories. As far as I know, that's rather subjective. We give higher probabilities to simpler theories, theories that are more elegant and beautiful and so on. We tend to have higher. But then we have to test them by look and see which alternative prediction of the theory we actually see. So the first is I suggest prior alternatives principle. A set of alternatives to be assigned likelihoods by theory should be chosen logically prior to the observation to be used to test the theory. So we should have alternatives in mind before we make the measurement, rather than saying we measure this and therefore we'll take the alternative to be the probability of this versus the probability that this is not true. Choose the alternatives for it. And then, of course, they should be the sum of the likelihoods should add to unity, and then. Well, this was my own for it. You don't have to accept this, that the alternatives should be chosen to be conscious perceptions or observer moments. But that's maybe for the future. So a contrast is what Brandon Carter's called the autocentric principle, that the alternatives should be chosen to be the existence of the actual observation and its non-existence. So that's your choosing the set of the alternatives after making the observation. So that's, I'm arguing against, for that sort of thing.
What's the argument against?
Against that other one?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's essentially like Bud Busso, Freevogel, and Yang said, that if you do that, you'll tend to get high likelihoods. I mean, if you have a huge number of things, you'll get high likelihoods for your observation, no matter what the theory is, and so you won't be able to test between the theories. So, you know, if you want to. Let's see. Let me skip that one here. Okay. There's another question. I need to go faster. Okay. The question about whether a theory would be a theory which is dominated by Boltzmann brains or not. If you had a finite volume universe in which ordinary observers lasted a finite time, there'd be a finite number of ordinary observers. But if the universe lasted forever because there's always four volume, it would seem that there's an infinite four volume for an infinite amount of production of Boltzmann brains. So that would seem to be a Boltzmann brain theory. Now, the tricky thing is if you have an infinite volume universe, if you go off this way, then there's an infinite number of both ordinary observers because there's infinite spatial volume and BB. So the ratio is ambiguous. This is the measure problem of cosmology. So this eternal inflation prediction, picture of Lindy, Blinken, Starbinsky, now this seems to predict an infinite volume universe. How to regulate the infinity is tricky, but then that's been discussed. But let's see if I should go on here. Let's see, how are we time? Maybe I should. Okay, so some questions. Maybe I'll skip the asymptotic. Well. let me just get a model that you could use. If you assume our universe is dust plus lambda, then if you put in the numbers, then this is sort of the rate, and then the dust plus lambda has this simple metric, and it coincidentally this is around one. So this is what I call a mnemonic universe. Cold dark lambda k equals zero. Freedom of Rockenwald with t naught equal x naught is 100 million years divided by the fine structure constant. Just a mnemonic device. In Planck units, the age is also, as I mentioned early at the beginning of the talk, that. So that's just a mnemonic universe for getting ours. Of course, it's not likely to be exactly the mnemonic universe. If you had, let me just see. I'm running a little late, so maybe I should. Let me skip that one. Suppose you wanted these Boltzmann brains. Suppose they appear at some very tiny rate per four volume. But suppose you wanted the universe not to do this. Suppose you said the universe is decaying, that there's a bubble formation rate that's sufficient to make the universe decay before there's far more Boltzmann brains. So suppose it's decaying quantum mechanically at some rate A for annihilation per four volume. Then the expectation by the four volume is infinite. Unless the annihilation rate is bigger than this. See, if the annihilation is less than that, then the universe is, the existence is decaying exponentially, but the volume is growing exponentially faster. So that the expected value goes infinity, you have an expected number of Boltzmann brains. So one possible solution, it has problems with fine tuning, is that our universe is decaying at an astronomical rate, corresponding to a time scale of around that, rather than the quantum recurrence time scale of that. Then you can calculate the survival probability up to some age, and you can calculate that the decay of that, it's about 10 to the minus 11 per year now, so that's equivalent to expected number of 7 humans dying per century. Of course, it wouldn't be 7 per century, it'd be in 10 to the 11th years, everybody maybe would die. Future half-life would be less than 19 gigayears. So this would mean if the universe was decaying quantum mechanically, of course there's problems with that, there's fine-tuning problems, because If the decay rate were bigger than that by, say, 1,000 times, then the problem would be going down so fast it would be unusual for us to be this late in the universe. We would have most likely formed earlier because the universe would most likely have decayed by now, so it would be surprising. So then this would give this in a narrow rate, in a logarithmic scale, the annihilation rate would have to be very narrow. If you use, for example, the estimate that gravitinos can lead to decay of the universe, you can get this, where this is up to an O1 factor, this is the gravitino mass. So if you put in this range, it corresponds to the mass range in here in Planck units. Well, this number is not too unreasonable, but the range is very narrow. It's only 0.6%, so it seems very tiny. You'd have to fine-tune things to get the decay rate big enough to avoid Boltzmann brains, but small enough that we could have been here. Also, you might say, even if in our bubble or region of the multiverse this happened, it seemed unlikely that other regions would have this, and so they might give an... You might have problems in other things. Well, of course, this depends on the landscape. So if there's no landscape, then maybe we don't have this last problem. But there's still a fine-tuning problem on the gravitino. Well, let's see. Other solutions. I think I'm running low, so let me skip that. Well, maybe just the amusing thing. If it did decay at an astronomical rate, then... If ordinary observers could, I mean, most likely we won't last 10 billion years, but if it did happen, this bubble happened, it would come at the speed of light, so you wouldn't see it to dread it. You'd be destroyed so fast that you wouldn't feel it, and there'd be no grieving survivors left behind. So in some ways, it'd be the most humane possible execution. And then there'd always be some fraction of your left. But the main point of my discussing the Boltzmann brain problem is not to say that my solution's bad. I mean, I don't really believe in my solution. I don't believe in any of the solutions yet. It's just to point out, to stimulate more research onto this mystery of the measure problem for the string landscape or other multiverse theory, or even for a theory where we have internal inflation with things, that it seems like at present the most naive things give you that thing. Okay, what I wanted to have as the last part is just another alternative, because of the problems I raised with the Hartle-Hawking thing, of another quantum possible thing for quantum state, which would be formed by doing Gitting-Meerhof group averaging techniques, but you start with a state that's asymptotically a single de Sitter spacetime in both past and future, and regular on a throat of this. So suppose you said, well, we're strict to states such that you, in the end, you get them by group averaging, but you start off with some with some configuration that has asymptotically just there in the past and the future, but of course you may have matter in here, and if you do have matter, there'll be some neck that has a globally minimum tree geometry. The tree geometry will be the smallest, where the matter tends to be concentrated before it's diluted out. So you could analyze, for example, if you took if you assume that you had a homogeneous isotropic neck with, say, a cosmological constant and then a scalar field, and then you also add thermal radiation. This is to get a certain number of states. Then, okay, the Hubble expansion rate's this, the second derivative is that. So the neck you'd need to have this quantity would have to be non-negative. So the neck you get this. Then if you did this Gibbons Hawking Stewart mini superspace constrains phase space would actually be finite at the neck. You'd get a finite measure for that thing. And if you want to maximize the entropy, you'd get it by having the scalar field at zero time derivative and have it just barely about to expand. So you can calculate then in that case what the temperature and the entropy. So the entropy would then be this number, and it would be basically, in terms of archivalue, the cosmological constant we put in the observed values, the entropy would be less than of order this thing. So it wouldn't be near as big as the De Sitter. Well, this would be the thermal entropy of this thing. It's somewhat large, but it's not... Then you could ask the question, suppose you had the scalar field rolling down the inflaton potential, and what I call classical inflation is just rolling down without these quantum fluctuations. So if you're in this regime where just the rolling down part dominates, then the number of E folds you get would be this, and the volume in the end would get this. And so the expectation value of the volume would be dominated by small values of the of finite. It's essentially dominated by no inflation. If you don't include the eternal inflation fluctuations, these sort of states would be dominated by no inflation. On the other hand, if you have that, if the volume from eternal inflation, if it's bigger than this criterion point for where the quantum fluctuations, when you multiply by the growth in volume, run you up the inflaton potential, then you could have infinite volume, and then you could calculate you need bigger values of this initial scalar field, so that restricts the initial volume, so the entropy is then smaller. It's about 10 to the 4.5. So then these no-bang states with internal inflation would have only a few 10,000ths of units of entropy. There's a small number of quantum states that are consistent with that. Now you might ask the case, suppose it could be anisotropic, then one extreme anisotropic metric is this Nari metric, which is basically Schwarzschild De Sitter, with the special case that the black hole horizon and the cosmological horizon have the same area. And so that metric you could write in this form. There's a two-sphere that has constant size. It stays constant, but then the other two-dimensional space is just this hyperboloid two-dimensional space that's just expanding in that dimension. It's exponentially expanding in one spatial dimension, but not in the other ones. Well, a generalization of this, if you allow some matter fields, is you can say, we'll just put some general function of x and then have some size of this. The size can also vary. So little x can run, you could have it periodic with little x going from zero up to big x. And you could always, of course, just normalize this so at t equals zero, say at the throat that this is one. And then you could have R1 for time and then S1 for the x and then S2 is that. Or you could have it if R of zero, if the size of the two sphere shrinks to zero to two ends, you could have the topology S3. So then if you put into the Einstein equations, you get this. And if the neck is a moment of time symmetry on it, then this Einstein constraint equation gives this in terms of the this is the derivative of the size of the two sphere as a function of x. So the primes mean derivatives with respect to x. You get that. So, okay, there's this homogeneous solution, and if you add thermal radiation, it has this much entropy. And the idea is that you, of course, by making the size of the S1 arbitrarily big, you could have arbitrarily big entropy in this thing. So this is, sometimes it's naively assumed that if you have a cosmological constant, that means there's a limit on the entropy. But if you allow the three space to be arbitrarily big, you can have arbitrarily large entropy. But,
slicing it differently?
Sorry?
Taking an open slice in the center, is that what you're talking about?
No. I'm taking just a cosmological concept. It's this Nari. It's a perturbation of Nari. So it's basically the Nari is S2 cross S1, and so I'm making the S1 very big. Or I could pitch it off, have it at S2, but it's a very long, skinny. It's a long, skinny S3, and I'm just saying you can make it sufficiently big that the entropy can get arbitrarily high. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the time, it causes R to collapse to zero in finite time for the homogeneous solution, both past and future. So in this case, it just is a big bang and a big crunch. It doesn't get asymptotically de-Sitter. But if you start off with inhomogeneous oscillating values of the radius of the two-sphere, you could have asymptotic de-Sitter regions where this term is sufficiently negative in the constraint up here and still unbounded total entropy. So you could still have, but what it seems to be is that it looks like that the whole thing splits up into different regions. Parts of it go into singularities. Part of it, the red part, is asymptotically de-Sitter. So you have asymptotically de-Sitter part. The total entropy, if you draw it across here, the total entropy here could be arbitrarily big because this could be arbitrarily long. But a conjecture might be that if you just restrict yourself to each asymptotic de-Sitter region into this, then maybe the entropy is restricted by some number of order that amount. So maybe if you just, maybe this, you know, it's a possible alternative that you don't really have a Euclidean region from there, you just had this neck, and here of course you might have many asymptotic ones, but then each one may seem to have possibly, I mean this is more of a guess than a conjecture, I guess I should say, that I don't know if this is falsified. You could certainly have arbitrarily large entropy with a cosmological constant, but the evolution seems to break up into many different asymptotic de-Sitter regions. So maybe the entropy in a single one is bounded by that. Okay, well I think I've gone on long enough. So okay, well this is only conclusion of part of the talk, but from the results of Susskind, it seems that because the Harlow-Hawking boundary thing would be dominated by the path integral over a great big giant part of a four-sphere from the present value of the cosmological constant, that seems to be inconsistent with the observations. Although, you know, there are possible resolutions. I mean, I'm not ruling it out completely, but it seems to have problems. And just raising the question, could this no-bang state be better? I don't know, but that's the thing. So thanks very much for your attention. Yes, Jim.
Could I just ask an historical remark? I mean, when the universe is very big, you get all sorts of problems with prediction because of Boltzmann brains or because of the data that's occurring. In some cases, you appear to be trying to limit the size of the universe by, so we can get too many Boltzmann brains or its age. But we've also talked about modifying quantum mechanics so that it would be more predictive. Are those ideas connected or? Do they work equally well?
Well, okay, when I've had discussions, like discussions I'm having with you, I'm suggesting maybe we should have probabilities that are expectation values not of orthogonal projection operators, but of maybe sums of projection operators, such that the sum is not itself a projection operator. Well, that's more in order to be able to get likelihoods for observations that are not very close to one in a very big universe. I mean, it seems to me that your beautiful work with Mark is showing that if you restrict yourself to probabilities from orthogonal projection operators, then you project on the, does this condition occur somewhere or does it not occur somewhere? And if the universe is big enough, then it almost certainly may occur somewhere, and then you get a likelihood very near one. So I guess my problem with that is that if the universe is really very big, then it would mean that we could not experimentally test different theories. We all the likelihoods would be unity for almost all of the theories. We wouldn't be able to discriminate them. So it's a somewhat different motivation from that. But the Boltzmann brain problems basically comes from assuming that you have done that. You have done that step so that the likelihoods really can vary with the theory. So, but, you know, if you had all the likelihoods near unity, no matter how many Boltzmann brains there are, then you could say, well, Boltzmann brains aren't a problem. But I would say we also wouldn't be able to deduce much else, because almost any crazy theory that predicts a large enough universe would be consistent with the observations.
So you need both.
Yeah. So in some sense, if you want to be able to test between theories, it seems like you want to have likelihoods that could be small if we're very rare among all possible observers or beings within our reference class, and then the Boltzmann brain problem arises. So then it seems like you also need to solve that. So right, this is not, it's modifying quantum is not a solution to the Bolson-Brain problem. Or it's not a solution of the Susskind's challenge to the Harlow-Hawking proposal. That would require other solutions.
What's the matter with just assuming we're not typical and we're not Boltzmann-Brains and we're not deluded?
Well, I think, I mean, the trouble with that is that then you could say any observational result is just, I mean, how do we know it isn't a fluke? I mean, maybe really the black microwave background temperature is 10 degrees, and it's just that the universe is so big that if you have, you know, if you have 10 to the 10 to the 10 observers all looking at the microwave background, even if it is 3 degrees, there'll be certainly some of those that will, some civilizations of those will see that it's 10 degrees. So, if it is 10 degrees, some of them will see it to be 3 degrees. So how do we know that we aren't just one of these fluke civilizations that sees it to be 3, even though it's really 10? So it would seem like, I don't see how we would be able to, you know, be fairly confident that our, that the universe is really rather like our observations indicate.
Suppose if in future our astronomer friend says that, well, the cosmological constant is zero, so absolutely zero, we may be living in a big void or something like that. So what would happen to the entire transparency we had, which you have talked about?
So, well, I suppose if it's zero, now it would still be a question is what is it? I guess it depends whether they say that the present indications that there is, the universe is accelerating, whether they'll find that's...
We could as well live in a big void, say, for instance. And, you know, they could not be having cosmological constant.
Yeah, but I mean, are you going to accept the present observations that seem to indicate that the distant galaxies are accelerating? Are you going to accept that or not?
No, I mean, I'm saying that in the future, if the astronomers somehow infer that we live in a big void such that it can explain all the observations, whatever we see, like microwave background radiation, the temperature.
But what's supposed to be the explanation of the apparent acceleration of distant galaxies?
I mean, all these things can happen. I mean, the big void could be big enough, to comment all these supernova data which we see today. I mean, all the z equals to 1 or z equals to 2, the entire big void could be, you know, as big as that. In principle, it could be survival.
So you're saying that there is a possible arrangement such that the apparent acceleration isn't an actual acceleration. It's just, yeah. Okay, so I suppose if it was that, then, okay, let's suppose that it just goes asymptotically zero cosmological constant. Well, of course, even then, I suppose if you had four-dimensional flat space-time, if it lasted long enough, you'd have this Bolson-Brain problem, but it would be very, very, you know, then you'd have to, the time length that it would have to last would be like e to the 10 to the 69 or something before you get to the problem, because it wouldn't be the exponential growth in the volume. So, I suppose you wouldn't have, but you'd still have. See, the Bolson-Brain problem even comes, even if you just said you didn't have gravity and just had flat Minkowski space-time, and you say that civilization was formed because matter came in and formed the Earth and the solar system, and it lasts for a little time, and it eventually decays and disperses back out to infinity. Then you might say, well, you have observers then, but if you have an infinite pore volume of flat space, and if observers can just nucleate by vacuum fluctuations, somewhere else, then because there's an infinite amount of other four volume, then that would probably dominate over this. So you'd still have some of a problem even if you had asymptotically flat space, but if you cut off the asymptotically flat space, you could cut it off at a much later time than the sitter thing.
When many measurements of the background temperature being a fluke essentially invalidate your ability to do science.
That's what I would...
And that gives me the feeling that maybe our science isn't ready for these questions.
I think what it indicates is that we should have some procedure, we should have some theoretical mechanism for explaining why our procedure does seem to work. And what I'm saying is that we're in danger of losing that if we use probabilities that are proportional to expectation values and of orthogonal projection operators, and if the universe is too big. So I'm just saying we should.
That's not the right way to think about it.
So yeah, I mean maybe that. I mean there's certainly lots of problems that no doubt we haven't thought about the right way. So.
I just wanted to offer in conjunction with what Eddington said, also, you know, put all the problems at the beginning of the universe. If you take consciousness and time, consciousness, I mean, is it not possible that it seems that consciousness transcends time? Because here we are with with our minds going to the beginning or the end or the nowhere of infinite universes. So it doesn't seem like consciousness is necessarily bound in time or possibly not bound in time. So you have another question.
Well, I mean, I do suppose that that in some sense, I don't think time exists as an absolute quantity, and I don't know in string theory whether it's absolute. So I wouldn't mind if things transcended time, but I mean, I do take the working hypothesis that consciousness is produced by the physical state of the universe. That I'm conscious because my brain's in the right state. But the trouble is, we just don't know the rules. We don't know the rules. What does the state of the brain have to be to give consciousness? We don't know the details of that. But I think it's, presumably it's a consequence of that.
Okay, let's thank Don.